tonight we are. It is election night here in the United States of America, November 3rd, 2020, and it's been a, I don't know, 2 year long. It seems like 2 year long election, the longest and most bitterly fought election that we have seen in our lifetime. I don't know, pretty close with the Hillary Trump one, equally as unpleasant. The title of the class is Parsha Vayera, which is this week's Parsha. Your friend voted for the enemy. What do you do next? So we'll leave it like that. So let's get into the videotape. I'm going to go to the, let's go to the video here. Here we go. Okay, do the old share screen.
Republican.
We argued about it and we said a couple things.
I wore a Trump shirt to school and everyone, you know, got all mad at me.
My friend Matthew, he was worried about his grandparents getting deported when Donald Trump became the president.
And they say, oh, you're bad because you like Donald Trump and I wanted Hillary, and they get mad at me.
Now all the way down to elementary school, politically divided, politically active.
Hillary for president!
Most Americans believe their country is today deeply divided. How deep? And is there any hope? Local Democrats we spoke with call this the reddest metro area in America. American dreamers, pickup trucks, lush lawns. Then you reach Leah Payne's house. Texans for Hillary still stuck in her lawn. Rainbow stars and stripes and a homemade Planned Parenthood wreath. Get the picture?
My neighbor to the north had a Trump sign. My neighbor across the street had a Trump sign.
Your Hillary sign is still there.
I voted for her, and I would do it again if I could.
These kids and their moms, staunch liberals living deep in a red state.
After the election, there were kids in the cafeteria talking about building the wall. There was this kind of baiting that was going on.
I get poked at and made fun of a lot for being the black sheep of the family. And they're concerned that being a Democrat means I don't have a relationship with God.
Over in deep blue Southern California, we met Republican women feeling similarly shamed. They meet on a private Facebook page to chat without the cyber backlash.
It's all Republican moms.
Yes, but not even necessarily Republican, we say, is if you support Trump. That's where it's kind of shifted to.
Okay.
The election, because it's gotten so bad for people, they need to plan a safe space.
In the course of my daily life in Los Angeles, I do not meet many Trump supporters.
People can't be out about it because it could jeopardize their career. We've got people in the entertainment industry, people who've got businesses.
We met these Trump-supporting moms and their kids at a GOP oasis, the Reagan Library in Simi Valley. They did not want their last names used.
You like politics?
Uh-huh.
Who'd you like?
What?
I like Donald Trump. I like politics because you get to see other people's point of view and what they like.
We first met 11-year-old Dwight and his mom in the summer at Politicon in Pasadena.
L.A., there's a lot of Mexicans. It's just, I feel like they're bringing in drugs and bad things.
We went because Dwight wanted to go. I wasn't going to go. He's like, we go to Politicon. It's like, all right.
Okay.
So, I voted for Trump in our school's mock election. And one of my friends asked me, she's like, oh, who'd you vote for? I'm like, oh, yeah, I voted for Trump. And then they're like, well, you're a disgrace. I'm like...
You're a disgrace.
Yeah, I'm like, well, I should have my own political beliefs. And I don't harass you for liking Obama.
I find that a lot of people who are on the left, they're very vocal about their opinions. But when I'm vocal about my opinions, I am racist, I'm intolerant.
Girls came up to her and said, Trump grabs women, and Trump da-da-da-da. And she comes home and tells me this stuff. And I said... Honey, it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
You know.
We live in this bubble.
You know, yeah.
L.A.
It's not a friendly environment. On my own Facebook page, it went to the mat.
L.A. County in November voting 72% for Clinton, 22.5% for Trump. You had a Jail Hillary sticker on your car, right?
Yes. It did not go well.
When Obama was elected, we didn't go out on the streets and protest and break things down and burn things. You know, we kept quiet for 8 years. So why can't the Democrats just let us have our fun?
It never used to be like this.
No, it didn't. It's never been this bad.
It's never been this bad.
It's never been this bad, but the issues have never been this critical. We have never had, you know, the level of national security threats. It's been very productive. The economy, the stock market, jobs,
Have you, like, lost friends over this?
Yes. I think it was already divided during Obama.
Pitting groups against others.
All right. Although that clip was from 2017, it could have been from yesterday. You know what I mean? It's the, it really nothing has changed. So let's go to the questions. All right. So number one, why are people so aggressive about their political views? Are people not just like have their political views? You see on both sides, Democrat and Republican, there's like they're super aggressive about it. Anybody have a thought about that? Now, just a disclaimer, this year is not endorsing any political party. This is about the attitudes about relating to the to politics. It's not where this is a neutral, nonpartisan or bipartisan sheer. I have to make that disclaimer. We've got a thought about that. Why are people so aggressive about their political views? Just like, okay, like, people don't get so, you know, up in arm about, you know, their favorite Netflix movie. You might get,
I can...
Go ahead, Brooke. Bavakasha.
Hello. So, I mean, for many people, it's, at least people in my circle see it as existential. People on the left see Trump as an existential threat to their identities, whether it's LGBT community or, you know, communities of color. And on the right, it's the same thing, especially some of the Orthodox communities I'm involved around that are more conservative and see the left as an existential threat to the Jewish people and to Israel. So, I mean, when it's an existential threat to your existence and you see it in those absolute terms, it's very easy to be passionate.
Passionate or even in this case, aggressive.
Aggressive, that's the word.
Right, aggressive. So now, why are the children, we saw in the clip on that Nightline, we're not talking about, I understand, you know, the Never Trumpers versus the, you know, the MAGA, you know, Make America Great crowd, you know, yelling and screaming at each other as adults, okay. But why are the children of these same people so aggressive with their friends and classmates? In other words, in the video clip, you have 10-year-old kids, you know, what they did there was they went to a Trump supporter in California. California, a traditionally very blue state, will of course go to Biden tonight without question. Versus Fort Worth, Texas, a very red state. Well, that's a question, but that's that particular neighborhood is extremely red, obviously. And if you're a Democrat there, you are a lonely man of faith or a lonely gal of faith there. So why are even the kids like that girl on the clip there? I don't know if you noticed that she lost this 11-year-old girl lost a friend because the person had an opposing political position. Okay, Scott, you have a thought about that?
Is it because like children kind of mimic their parents?
Yes,
they learn from their parents.
Okay, so, I mean, all right, so, but, okay,
you want to
true, yes,
watch.
Correct, but there's more there. In other words, you know, there's a lot of stuff that mom and dad does that kids don't, they might unconsciously absorb, but then, you know, why does the vocalness, the vocalness transcend the generation? That's unusual. There are a lot of things that, you know, I do that
it's
my kids,
like,
again.
You know, like you grew up like, you know, your parents grew up, you know, your dad, mom and dad grew up like a Mets fan. Like, you know, you're kind of like, you know, you're going to be a Mets fan.
Okay.
It's like if they're kind of like one side or the other, kind of like early in your life, you might kind of lean toward that side before you kind of like get old enough to make up your own decision.
Well, can a Mets fan be a friend with a Yankee fan?
Oh, no.
No,
no way.
No way. No way. So, right. So, would the friendship break up over the fact that they had opposite baseball allegiance?
No, because
or the friendship would never even initiate.
If like the Mets or the Yankees won the World Series, it wouldn't be like, oh God, like country's gone.
Here, I think it's a little bit more extreme than that. I think that, first of all, that is true. Bonding over sports is an American pastime. People do that 100%. But seems it's a little more. Anybody else with thoughts? Suzanne, what do you say? I'll bring you into the conversation.
Oh.
Sorry, I know.
I've been yelled at by both Democrats and Republicans, so I cannot wait until this is over.
Okay.
But, I feel like there's way more at stake than... And I'm a Jets fan, and they constantly lose, so...
Giants aren't doing much better. Last night they lost in a very sad Monday Night Football debacle.
On the bright side, you might get the number one pick.
There you go. Oh, okay.
Well,
all right, go on, Suzanne. Go on.
Doesn't matter. I heard the little boy he had to be parroting what his parents were saying with such gusto, and... And there's more at stake. It's like what Brooke was saying. I mean, and the stakes are just higher and people are feeling threatened, and that's being passed down to their children who see this. It's also probably a bonding experience, similar to what Scott was saying, but a lot more at stake. And they're very passionate, and the parents are probably, the kids saying things that Mexican, they're bringing drugs into the country, and
right,
which is mirroring
Donald Trump's first speech when he started running for president in the 2016 election. So to put it succinctly, politics for many have become the new modern secular religion. It's a secular religion. And even though America now, for most people, for many people, are not so passionate about religion, either they're agnostic or they have no religion or it's something very neutral. They're very, they're very par about religion. But politics, they become ideological firebrands, and they become very energized and excited about it. And therefore their kids absorb it. When 11-year-old kid is using Trump or Hillary or Biden talking points, they're just hearing that in the home. It's an ideology. It's essentially in a religion. It's essentially a religion. Religion, I use in the term, all the bad connotations of the word religion. In other words, it's not very well thought out. It's basically like a catechism. It's like sort of like repeat. It becomes a dogma. It's not something of a reflection. It's something that people, parrot. And not only that, one of the sad things, I don't know if you caught in the first part of the video, is that within a family, it's Thanksgiving, the old Thanksgiving dilemma. You got maybe an older crowd, just I'm going to use a stereotype, maybe the older crowd might run a little more Republican, and you might have some, guy... Uncle Dave at the Thanksgiving dinner, wearing the Make America Great red hat, and then you got his niece from NYU, who is a Bernie Sanders supporter, devastated that he has this right-wing Democrat running. Biden, Joe Biden he's basically a Republican. Okay, and then having those two people together at the Thanksgiving, family get-together, that's just a bucket of unpleasantness. So so some families have the rule, we do not talk politics, anything but. We'll talk religion, we won't talk politics, okay? Anybody got something on the Parsha? So won't talk about politics. So that's why you have, it gets to the point that that woman was, I forgot if she was a Republican or Democrat, was essentially ostracized from other members of the family because she did not align with their political beliefs, which is no different than if a person is Jewish and becomes a Roman Catholic, or Roman Catholic becomes a Jew, changes their religions, that is not going to make everybody in the family happy. It's going to be an issue. Okay, so now that's the context. Now let's share screen over here for our next little item over here. Some shocking research here. All right, so let me have Shayna read us out this shocking information. It's from Pew.
Jocelyn Kiley, Associate Director of Research at the Pew Research Center, said political polarization is more intense now than at any point in modern history. Nearly 80% of Americans now have just a few or no friends at all across the aisle, according to Pew, and the animosity goes both ways. Another recent poll by the Public Religion Research Institute shows that 8 in 10 Republicans believe the Democratic Party has been taken over by socialists, while 8 in 10 Democrats believe the Republican Party has been taken over by racists. The report is aptly named, titled Dueling Realities.
Okay, so if you look over at this infographic, majorities of Trump and Biden voters say that they have just a few or no friends to support the other candidate. So this is a percentage of registered voters who say of their close friends support, same candidate. So 59% of registered voters say that 59% of their close friends support the same president. So basically, people are in varying echo chambers. They're in the Fox News world or the MSNBC world, and they're living in that, and they're just talking the same points that has been prepared for them. And nobody has real friends who are on the other side. I mean, it's just, and this is a first. I'm a little bit older than everybody here on the call here tonight. I never remember it like this. Yeah, they're always Republican and Democrats and even independents, but the animosity we're at a all-time high, and that is not a good thing. So here's a question. Can a Republican and a Democrat get married to each other? So Shayna gives us thumbs up.
A good friend of mine in the community, she is, I would call her probably a moderate Democrat, and he's probably a moderate Republican. They are very happily married to each other, and they try not to talk politics, but... They also have a rule of no, like, if you have come for Shabbat meal, there's no politics at the table, but sometimes it's inevitable. And while she and I disagree on some things, we also agree on other things. And so we're able to have, I guess, like an adult-level conversation about it.
Okay.
It's more about keeping a level head, an open mind, and being respectful of the other person. And how you discuss your thoughts on politics with them.
Okay, so Shayna actually knows a couple who are Republican, who are married to, and not only married, but happily married, okay? Anybody else know such a couple? Scott also.
I'm pretty sure I know.
I'm going to go to Chaim next.
The famous couple, James Carville.
Oh, Miguel, okay, obviously you took my thunder. That's my next video. Obviously.
The
all right.
Raging Cajun.
The Raging Cajun, we're getting to that one. Go ahead, Chaim. You're on mute.
No, I was just saying, I know different people that have, their political differences are different, and they have boundaries around it, and more so today, actually, than ever, because of certain issues and lies, or proposed lies of somebody I voted for. But,
okay.
I would say, though, also, there's also a different level of, like, whatever, I'm not the one for this, but, like, this, like, I look at it as, like, maybe there's an overreaction, and there's definitely, like, that, like, this person happens to be an artist, and, like, specifically chose to be an artist because they were anti the money-grubbing lifestyle, I guess you could say, and more caring about humanity and social impact, And in that aspect, like, the person literally, I would say, has, like, almost like PTSD trauma reactions and anxiety that is very, very real to the person. So I make up there's definitely extra stress in the house around that. But till now, it was definitely just different opinions, different things, different ideologies. And, like, who survived. And now I think it had more of an impact this election and what happened this year specifically and the different aspects of
Correct. I mean, I think Chaim, you're on point. When I grew up, it was very common to have a couple who, as they used to say, our votes cancel each other out. You know what I mean? That was a very common thing. Elise and Larry, you guys remember that? You had couples that, you know, had different, that would vote for, you know, Democrat or Republican. Do you remember it back in the day? A little bit?
Are you saying I'm old, Rabbi Penny? Is that what you're trying to say?
You might have a little more experience than other people on the call.
It's the beard. It's the beard.
It's the lack of hair and the gray hair.
Yeah.
Although I would say, too, the other thing I would say is that I think, absent this year, if you go back to, say, like 2012, right, with Mitt Romney versus Barack, I don't think it was such a big
thing. It was not as bad.
Right? I don't think people were going nuts over Mitt Romney not winning. And I think people could also go back and forth if they like a particular candidate.
Right.
I mean,
Okay. All right. So, of course, so what Scott pointed out, I'm going to share a video. One of the most amazing couples that Lily, it's not just Republican, Democrat, is the fact is we have Mary Madeline, who is not just was simply a Republican. She was a Republican strategist who ran the Bush campaign. And then you had James Carville, who successfully ran Bill Clinton's successful 1992 campaign. And they were secretly dating, and then it got out, and they got married. And here they are. And they sometimes are on various, cable shows. They talk. And this is just, it's an amazing thing to watch. So I'm just going to, the question I want you to think about is, like, how do they do that? Because they're not just like, some people are not that into politics. They're like, yeah, I'm Republican, I'm Democrat, I'm independent, whatever it is. And it's like a very small part of their life. They're not so, you know, ippity-snippity. No, these are full-time, professional, political strategists who are constantly writing, constantly being interviewed, constantly, I mean, you don't get more hardcore political, you know, part of the political, industry, if you will, than these two, who are both very bright and accomplished people. So let me do the, let's go to the videotape, as they say. Okay.
I mean, look at the front runner, Mitt Romney. I mean, I know Romney looks like a president, but we don't always get the job we look right for. If we did, I'd be the king of the snakes.
That, of course,
that's
Bill
my
Hader
man.
Saturday
that's
Live
my
Mayor.
Man.
That's your man. He's Bill Hader is great, isn't he? I think you really nailed something with your husband there.
You know, Dennis Miller once said that James is the only snake oil salesman he knows that actually looks like a snake. And conservatives have a term of endearment for James. It's serpent head. So that's my man. Look at him. There he goes. It's just like him.
Yeah. He's adorable. And he just gets cuter as the years go by.
The SNL guy, not James. Let's clarify.
I was speaking of James, but Bill Hader indeed is a good-looking guy as well. You know what? When I first started watching cable politics shows, the first show I watched and got hooked on was Equal Time with Mary Madeline and Dee Dee Myers. And I thought you girls were just amazing. It was like hanging out with two smarter girlfriends who knew what was going on and had polarized views, but you had such an obvious affection for each other, and you loved each other, and you know, you're married to the raging Cajun, a Democrat, and, we're in such a bitterly partisan time in our politics. Do you have any advice from, you know, having friends who are on the left and a marriage with two children that works with a Democrat for our splintered political system, which it gets worse every day?
No, I don't have advice. People tend to say... Well, people tend to think about us that either our politics or our marriage is a fake. And I'll tell you, we have bigger fights in our marriage than we do over our politics. I respect his politics. He's not right, but not being right doesn't make him the wrong man, for me, you just got to respect where the other guy's coming from. I was 40 and he was 49 when we got married. I know why I'm a conservative. I know why he's a liberal. And he's just wrong. Look at all these old pictures. Stop with the hairdos already. I can't take it anymore.
All right. So, question is, so how do they make their marriage work?
Their religion, you know, doesn't, not religion, their politics doesn't define them.
That's not really true, because they're not like mildly into their political philosophy. They are 100%, you know, dealt in. Not only is she Republican, she went the next level. She went full on libertarian, by the way. Or Republican wasn't even more right wing enough. And James Carville basically was responsible, from a strategic standpoint, to deliver and help Bill Clinton to become the President of the United States.
Rob, I think that example is actually an easier one to recognize. I don't know how they met and how they fell in love, quote unquote, or how they jived, right? But it's the type of thing where, you know, it could be a very interesting romantic story of they were fighting and then they found something. I mean, it's one of those things where people go to work and they leave their stuff at work and they come home, right? So I could definitely see an aspect of that, or the actual push-pull being part of their dynamics of what makes them, you know, have passion towards whatever. I don't know that well enough to say that, but I'm saying that could be like more of a movie fantasy marriage, and I don't know how.
Opposites attract, right?
Right. I know. I'm saying as far as how they are, as far as Nito's in the house, right? Take, you know, honey, you help me do this, you do this, right?
Right.
But anything from an affair happening in the back room when they're working against each other, or they're in their. You know, and also, what age do they meet? They meet when they're working campaigns at 18 to 20.
No, 40, age 40, 39, 40. Right. All right.
So they're a little past all that stuff, and now it's just, this is their job, this is their life. They can't go become a different position in life. So it's not as much of a friction than two people nowadays.
Okay. Let me hear Brooke. Dad, Brooke.
The key thing that stood out to me was when she said, building on what Chaim said, that she was 40 and he was 45 when they met. I mean, they clearly had already clearly had very, very well developed senses of self that didn't depend on the other. And so they probably in that case weren't threatened by the other's views, and they could, I think something about their developed sense of self has to do with it.
I think that's a very good point. And also she said very revealingly that he's a good guy. Even though he's wrong, in other words, even though that he's a liberal, that's not the totality of him. He has other good midot, other good qualities, and she loves him for him, and the fact that, and they probably don't, you know, endlessly talk about politics left, right, and center, you know, it's annoying. So they talk about their life. They argue about regular married people's stuff. You know, what they, on another interview, which I was picking videos, is, you know, they argue more about money than politics, because that's what most couples argue about, you know. Larry, I got a laugh out of Larry.
If you push that agenda, we have to pay more out of pocket.
Yeah, but whatever. I think there's another thing, is that they're very, if you watch them, they're fairly highly actualized people, which means they're very thoughtful, reflective people, and they can hear what the other person's saying, and they're not. They're transcending to a degree beyond a very hardened ideological, unreflective ideological position. Shane, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, that she just kept repeating, or the way she spoke about how they interacted with each other, she kept using the same word, and that was respect.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is a key thing that's missing in most political debates these days.
That is an excellent observation, Shayna.
Shayna, I didn't express that, and that was one of the points I was trying to make.
Okay, well, Shayna's helping you out. Okay, so just to put into a marriage context, there's just a book that I recommend for everybody to read. Dr. Gottman, Dr. John Gottman and his wife are two marriage therapists who do research on couple therapy out of Seattle, Washington. My old town. They have to be personally observant, just on the Jewish and observant, just parenthetically. It has no bearing on their research. But one of their key elements of a successful marriage is, as in the foundations, is that the couple, the two people in the marriage, as two friends, have sort of a primary respect for one another. It's not about attraction. In other words, do they respect each other as a person? So Mary Magdalene, even though she doesn't like his politics, she respects him, Jay Carville, as a person. And conversely, she feels the same way about him. And that's why he could be the liberal and she could be the conservative, and that's fine. And they could even be brought onto with CNN or to argue, and that's also fine. Of course, they might get on each other's nerves, but that's a part of marriage also. So that's kind of stuff. So this is in a certain sense, this is our introduction to an episode in this week's Parsha of the every week. We're in the second week of the Parshiot about Avram Avinu, Avram and his wife Sarah, dealing with various challenges. In this one, which we're about to learn about, with Avram going to the area of Gerar, which is close to modern-day Gaza, they come into a city-state controlled by a guy named Avimelech, which is sort of like a city-state. And we're going to read that story right now. Okay, let's go to the sheet. All right, everybody see the sheet? Let me make it a little bigger. Okay. All right. Here we go. All right, Shana, start us off.
Abraham migrated from there to the land of the Negev, and he settled between Kadesh and Shur. He would often visit Gerar. There he announced that his wife Sarah was his sister, and Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent messengers and took Sarah. God came to Abimelech in a dream that night. "You will die because of the woman you took," he said. "She is already married." Abimelech had not come near her. He said, "O Lord, will you even kill an innocent nation? Didn't her husband tell me that she was his sister? She also claimed that he was her brother. If I did something, it was with an innocent heart and clean hands." God said to him in the dream, "I also realize that you have done this with an innocent heart. That is why I prevented you from sinning against me, not giving you an opportunity to touch her. Now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet. He will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not return her, you can be sure that you will die, you and all that is yours." Abimelech got up early in the morning, and he summoned all his servants. He discreetly repeated all these words to them, and the men were very frightened. Abimelech summoned Abraham and said to him, "How could you do this to us? What terrible thing did I do to you that you brought such great guilt upon me and my people? The thing you did to me is simply not done." Abimelech then asked Abraham, "What did you see to make you do such a thing?" Abraham replied, "I realized that the one thing missing here is the fear of God. I could be killed because of my wife. In any case, she really is my sister. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. She later became my wife. When God made me wander from my father's house, I asked her to do me a favor. Wherever we came, she was to say that I was her brother." Abimelech took sheep, cattle, and male and female slaves, and he gave them to Abraham. He also returned Abraham's wife Sarah to him. Abimelech said, "My whole land is before you. Settle wherever you see fit." To Sarah he said, "I am giving your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Let it be compensation for you and all who are with you for all that has been done. You can stand up tall." Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, as well as his wife and slave girl, so that they were able to have children. God had previously sealed up every room in Abimelech's house because of Abraham's wife Sarah.
Okay, so that's a heck of a story. All right, so let me just sort of summarize simply. This was the second time that Sarah was abducted from Avram. Avram, in the beginning of Lecha, went down to Egypt, and Sarah was apparently a very attractive woman, and Paro's people abducted her, and he goes into the, and she is taken into his harem, and God has to intervene to sort of afflict Paro, and then Paro, when he realizes it, gives him back Sarah, and they survive. Sometime later, Avram is in Gerar, and the same thing happens, but the difference is that in this story, God intervenes by coming to Avimelech in a dream and having a conversation with him, which we can get into a little bit, and B, then there's a second conversation of Avimelech being angry at Avram, like, hey, what you do? Why'd you do this to me? And then ultimately giving Sarah back, giving them gifts, sort of like a restitution or some sort of repairing the sense of offense and damage. And Avram prays to Avram because apparently God had afflicted Avimelech and his court. They were able not to have children, and then they all become healed. And everything, you know, and then all's well ends well. But so let me start off with a basic shot question. Is Avimelech justified in being angry at Avram? When he says, how can you do this to us? What terrible thing did I do to you that you brought such a guilt upon me and my people? The thing you did to me is simply not done. And then he reiterates it. What did you see to make this such a thing? Do such a thing. Is Avimelech justified in his anger toward Avram? What would you guys say? Who would like to weigh in on that?
Yes.
Okay, why yes? That's okay, I want more than just yes. All right, well.
As far as from his perspective, he didn't need to be lied to. He didn't need to be tricked. He's an upright citizen. He's justified with everything he does. And he's a perfect person.
Okay. So, Avimelech is 100% in the right. So, but then the question, why did he give all the cattle and all the and the 1,000 pieces of silver and all, and you could have all the land? Why was he so magnanimous to Avram if there was nothing, he did nothing wrong? And when you see that he's very generous or afterwards.
It seems like he's repenting, like he has such guilt that he's doing everything he can, and I think he probably also wants to make Hashem happy as well, that he's, you know, even though he really didn't do anything wrong because he didn't know she was married, he's trying to do everything he can to make up for it and more.
Right. In fact, God says to him in the dream, I also realize that you have done this with an innocent heart. That's why I prevented you from sinning against me, not giving you an opportunity to touch her. So it seems that even God is saying that he's of innocent heart. So God seems to, like Chaim, backing up Avimelech. But you guys see nothing wrong with the series of events here.
I don't see anything wrong. I said, from Avimelech's point of view.
Did Avimelech do anything wrong?
I mean, he obviously did to get to the place where he had the reputation, where now Avram came along and had to do what he did.
Well, be more specific.
Meaning his reputation is that he would take a wife, and he wouldn't care.
What about the taking the woman part? What seemingly the abduction part? Nobody seems to be. I'm in a class of many women here. Nobody had noticed that. I mean, they didn't like. He didn't ask her to go out for dinner. Let's read the pasuk again. There he announced he would offer an agrar. He announced his wife was his sister, and Avimelech sent messengers and took her.
What's the Hebrew? I don't know what, but like the verb for took, is it
Vayikach, to take.
So, like meaning abducted or like.
Well, I don't know if the messenger has grabbed her by the hair. I don't know exactly, but they didn't say, hey, would you like to, would you be interested in joining Avi Melech's harem? I don't know if that was the conversation. I don't know exactly what they said, but it was not, they made her an offer that she could not really refuse. I mean, he's the king, therefore he's the lawmaker. So, you know, that does, there's not a whole lot of choice going on there. Suzanne, you had a question?
No, I was just going to say, like, it. This was, like, seemed like the lesser of two evils. Avraham knew it was either that he would take her. So, Avi Melech, I think, on some level knew, I'm known as this guy. Somewhere underneath this, he maybe had some insight into the fact that he gave some gifts. So,
you're saying that he was a little overly generous, not in addition to what Elise said, not just simply to as an act of tshuva. There was part of them recognized that he what he was there's an element of he was wrong on some level.
Right.
All right. So let's see how Rashi parses the words very carefully. He noticed something. So let me have somebody read Rashi who have not read yet. All right, Chaim, you're reading.
Okay, let's look at the largest. Bachem leva, mitem levavi, in the integrity of my heart, I did not intend to sin. With an akinyan bavi, and in the innocence of my hands, I am innocent of sin, because I have not touched sin.
So then God replies back.
Yadati ki mitem levavcha, I know that in the integrity of my heart, it's true that at first you had no intention of sinning, but you cannot claim innocency of hands, Genesis Rabbah, because lo nesaticha, I permit you not, I was not of your own, it was not of your own that you did not touch it, but it was I, in other words, God is the one who withheld it from sinning, with you from sinning, and I did not permit you the possibility to touch it.
Okay, so according to Rashi, what part of Avimelech's claim of innocence is valid according to Rashi? And what part of his claim is not valid? So, because just use a phrase, he has two phrase. He used two terms: tam levavi, innocence of heart, and nikyon kapai, innocence of hands or cleanliness of hands. So Rashi part notes the distinction: what part was legit and what part was not legit?
It was legit that he really did not intend to commit a sin. But what's not legit is he would have gone further with her if he wasn't stopped by Hashem.
Correct.
Right. Correct. You know, abduction itself is not a sin because any guy could take a girl back then, a woman back then, right? But to take a married woman, that was an abduction.
So, well, all right. So that gets into question number six. In what sense was Avimelech guilty of sin?
He did take a married woman.
Now, and in other words, even though at that particular moment he did not really know, in other words, he was, you know, Tom Levavi, innocent of heart, he did not know that she was a married woman. That is true. But Nikyon Kapai, in other words, but he has you have to look at sometimes a sin in a much more holistic perspective. In other words, yeah, but you created you're running. This is mentioned earlier. Some of you mentioned before. You're running a country or a city state where, basically, women do get, you know, forced into a relationship with the king with not much choice, and that's a little. In other words, yes, technically he thought that she was single, so that part he's you know. But bottom line is he's still running a state where women who don't get a lot of choice get taken. And it was only because God stopped him. He would have obviously slept with her, obviously. So the sin is a little more not micro to the... Yes, he did not... Did he know he's taking a married woman? No, he did not know he's taking a married woman. Did he think he had a single woman? Yes, he did. That's true. But he's not innocent of hands. In other words, the fact that God only says he was Tam Levavi and not Nick Yom Kippai means there was a measure of guilt associated with him, and God had to intervene because his whole manner was basically taking women to be part of his harem, and that intrinsically is a problem. Okay, now, how did Rabbi Melech justify his claim of righteousness? What was his blind spot about himself and his country's righteousness? And in what sense is Abimelech creating a bubble which justifies his righteousness? That's a lot of questions, but you know. What do you guys say? How did Abimelech justify his claim of righteousness? What do you guys got to say? Shayna, what do you say, Shayna?
He said he didn't touch her and that he had no intention of touching her.
Well, that's not true. He did not bring a woman into his harem not to touch her. That's a pointless activity. He definitely abducted her to be his wife, to be one of his wives. He definitely wanted to sleep with her. That's why he took her. That's why he had her taken, more accurately. But how did he justify it?
That he hadn't touched her yet.
Okay, that's sort of like a little bit of a legalistic weasel point. I mean, he goes very aggressive on it. He says to Hashem even, he goes aggressive against Hashem. He says, "Oh Lord, will you even kill an innocent nation?" He's doubling down. He's in a certain sense saying, you know, I'm a tzaddik over here. I'm innocent. In other words, do you hear a lot of humility in his conversation with God? He's saying, you know, God says, you will die because the woman you took, she's already married. And now he says, will you even kill it? First of all, God did not bring up his nation. He brings it in. In other words, rhetorically, God's sort of talking to him. You took a married woman. If you don't give her back, you're going to die. Okay? He says then Hashem, Abimelech says to God, "O Lord, will you even kill an innocent nation?" So he has a certain sense of himself and his people as being what? As being very moral, and we're a just society, and to kill me will be the height of injustice. I checked all my boxes. This woman, I asked her. She says she's single. I asked her brother. She says it's the brother. I did everything all right. This is glad kosher, God. Is everything good here? So, yeah. So he has, and even God says, yeah, you have you are innocent of heart. You did not know that she was, you did not know that she was married. That's true. But you're not clean of hands because the bottom line is, yeah, I stopped you from sinning. The reality is, because globally you have a kingdom where taking of women is like a thing. That's a problem in its own right. In other words, the fact that Abram has to walk in there knowing that if he does not lie, what's going to happen? Let's say Abram, what did Abram say when he's pressed by Abimelech? What was it? It says when Abimelech says to Abram, why did you see to do such a terrible thing? He's blaming Avram. This is your fault, Avram. You came in here. You misrepresented this woman. You say she's single. She's really your wife. Why'd you lie? And Avram says, in a succinct way, I realize the one thing missing here is fear Hashem, Yiras Hashem. And I could have been killed of my wife. In other words, even though externally you're very moral, but since you don't have that fundamental fear of Hashem, and that you can do what does a person do who in their own mind is very moral, but when they want something very, very bad, they can rationalize and justify what they're doing is the height of morality. So Avram says in nice ways, he didn't say it as direct, look, Abimelech, I know that you view yourself as a very moral person, but I detect in your society that there is no fear of Hashem, which means is that if you want something, it will happen. And you know what would happen? I would be in the bottom of the river with concrete shoes, and my wife would be your wife. So I knew that I would be basically, I knew that if the truth is told, I would be killed. And, you know, so he's basically saying that a person can be very passionate about how moral and righteous they are, but they, Avimelech had a, in his own mind, had a bubble in his own ideology that we the people of Gerar, we are kind, compassionate, just people. But that's their veneer. Avram says, you know what it is? It's baloney. Because when push comes to shove, and if I would have told you up front, Sarai is my wife, well, that would have not ended. She would not remain my wife because something would have bad happened to me. I would end up having an accident. And then she would not be my wife because she would be a widow. Okay? So, now, if Avram felt that this was a just and moral society, and even if he's married to a beautiful woman that the king would want, and they knew they can control themselves, if they view that they are subject to a higher power, if they recognize that there is a wisdom and there's a morality beyond themselves, that's one thing. But he says, no, you're the king. You know who makes up the reality? Who makes up the justness? You do. You are the lawgiver. There's no chance of any success here. So he created a bubble where he's defined or views himself as a righteous person. Question number 8. How does Avimelech's bubble justify a system in which the women of others are treated unfairly once they enter the country? How does he explain that? In other words, obviously this was a thing. There was already messengers, in other words, part of Avimelech's staff. What is Avimelech's staff in charge of? What do you see from the beginning part of the story here? Notice this. Catch this. There he announced that his wife was Sarah, was his sister. Avimelech, who are sent messengers, and took Sarah. He has messengers. What do these messengers do? Was this the first time that ever happened in Gerar, do you think? Was this a first-time event? What's going on? Give me a little texture to this society. Give me a little flavor to this society. What's going on here? What society is it similar to that you recognize?
Like our society?
In what sense?
Or in different camps, like on one side or the other.
Well, what society do you see that they're messengers and they're taking women? In America, I don't see overtly there's the abduction of women tolerated. Thank God, I'm not saying it doesn't happen. What kind of society is this?
You're not talking about like trafficking, are you? Is that what?
No, there's no trafficking. They're not taking them to. They're not abducting women to make them into sex slaves. That's not what he's doing. If a beautiful woman comes into the kingdom, that woman is what? Worthy of the king.
Worthy of the king, okay.
Worthy of the king.
I mean, that's kind of like the fundamental Mormonism concept, actually. I mean, that's kind of what ended up happening after time, is that men would just claim kind of their wives.
I'm not familiar enough about Mormons that I don't know.
It's just the fundamentals, not fundamentalists.
I know that they tolerated for much time polygamy, but I don't think they can go to somebody else's wife and take the wife.
And the FLDS, that's what's going on, actually.
All right, so I got to do some more research about that.
Gets the longer story then. Okay.
All right.
I'm the only one who watches weird cultures.
All right, so that I got to check that out.
I mean, isn't that like the whole, like, whatever it was, not Saudi, but in one of the countries, I think in Borat they made that joke also, like, well, the dictators,
Right.
Off at the heads, or they get the woman, or both?
Exactly. This is a mark of an authoritarian regime, is that the leader or the leaders can, like Saddam Hussein.
King David basically did that as well.
That's a little more. He didn't just abduct her. That's a whole complicated story. The story of David and Bathsheba is a complicated story. That's a class in its own right. But
that's also like similar to what you said last week with Solomon and talked about the challenges. I mean, the Gemara of Azura clearly says that specific thing, right? David and Bathsheba and the Jews people on the eagle. As an unfair tilt that God also taught us the lesson of Tshuva, but we know the sin was real.
Yeah. No, King David sinned with Bathsheba, but that's not the same thing as having part of your kingdom as being an abduction of women. That's not the same.
That was not the point.
Okay, so let's go into more contemporary times. Not that long ago, we all remember Saddam Hussein. When he ran Iraq, and he had two his two sons, they would go out in a limousine throughout the cities of the main cities of Iraq, Baghdad, and if they saw women they liked, they would just take them. And that's a mark of any kind of a ruler, or maybe a true for in America or a mafioso guy. You can do the same thing. In other words, you're not going to say no, because that could be very dangerous to your health. Okay, anybody who has violent power can do this. So on one hand, he has a state where women can be taken. Also, we learn, of course, the most egregious example was the case of King Ahasuerus. After his wife Vashti died, he seemed to have taken all the beautiful women in the entire land. He, which of course is a tragedy to the literally hundreds, if not thousands, of women who are stuck in the harem, and that's that. But here's the crazy thing, that he's justifying in his side that he's God. Would you destroy a nation, a righteous nation? In other words, he's speaking. On one hand, he has this going on, right? The taking of the women. On the other hand, he views himself as a moral person. He's pushing back on God, that why am I getting punished here? He's also yelling at Avram that, why'd you do this to me? So his sense of himself being like completely a big tzaddik, where it's so obviously laughable, is possible when a person has sort of like bought their own lie, has bought their own ideology. Go to now question number 9. How might Avimelech bubble cause him to unfairly judge other nations' way of life? And which, of course, getting to question number 10, which is the obvious connection for tonight, what bubble of self-righteousness do both Democrats and Republicans live in?
Well, I definitely live in the bubble as a, like, whatever you want to call it, Republican, of, like, it's not so bad. And not as, I definitely, like, make it out that all the Trump stuff is less than it is. And, like, a grain of salt, not a big deal, doesn't affect us. So there's definitely a naive aspect on my area that I can speak to.
Well, both parties right now, which are being, in a certain sense, impacted by their radical extremes of both the right and the left, if they... they will always say, the mark is, the measurement is, can you identify on the other side that the other side has a good idea or has done something successful? If you hear people saying there's nothing good about Trump or there's nothing good about Biden, that is your poker tell, that basically they are a person's living in a self-justifying bubble, that their ideology, their world is 100% good and has all the answers and has nothing but success. And the other side are wicked people who are undermining our society, who are every imaginable evil has the other side. these are all signs of that the person's in a bubble of self-righteousness, or what they call nowadays in an echo chamber of self-righteousness.
So,
Sarah Lewison.
Discuss politics before you get married is a good policy. My husband and I found out the hard way afterwards, so we are on complete opposite ends of the spectrum. And so we both, I think, live probably in our own little bubbles, so we avoid divorce by just not discussing.
Sarah, before you got on, we discussed, is it possible for a Republican and a Democrat to be married? Shayna shared her personal experience of her friends who are married. And of course, the example, James Carville and Mary Madeline, both Democratic and Republican strategists who are married and have seemingly have a good marriage.
Yeah, I mean, you just avoid talking about things a lot. is kind of the key I mean, obviously, politics was not as important, right, if it didn't come up before the wedding. I definitely think, at least I feel, my husband lives in that kind of bubble where, like, you can't talk about anything where, you know, like, any kind of topic that comes up will just be, like, you can't even, like, go there into sphere, which I think is a little different than how we grew up. Like, I feel like people weren't like this back in the day. Now it's like you can't even, like, touch it.
All right, so that's a question. Sarah, I want to understand that. This is a psychological question. How does the bubble phenomena cause such aggressive behavior? Whether the person's in a Democratic bubble or in a Republican bubble, it doesn't make a difference.
Why does it make it aggressive?
Why does it cause such aggressive behavior against the other side?
Seems to be attacking the premise of who you are as a person. It seems to be why everyone seems, like right now at least, is very one way or the other. And, you know, if you feel differently, then there seems to be no ability to have a calm, nice conversation about it.
Yeah, but why is that? What's the cause of that?
I think it's just because that's how politicians have become. And so I feel like it's like, you know, there's no longer just there can't be any real debate between them, and I feel like that's kind of become what we are as well.
You're kicking the question down the road. In other words, so you're saying the people are mirroring the politicians who are so ideologically in their positions, anchored in their positions. So why does their bubble cause such aggressive behavior? You know what I'm saying? I'm trying to understand the cause. So you're saying it's a trickle down from the politicians, the right and the left, have taken such polarized positions. And that, of course, is their messaging, and that gets to the people, and the people basically embody that. So whether the person is a Rush Limbaugh clone or the MSNBC show clone of mirroring those same points, but I'm just trying to think why does the bubble create such aggressive behavior? The bubble of self-righteousness.
Yeah, I don't know if I have a good answer for it.
Okay, so somebody, anybody else? We'll start picking on people.
I mean, we could throw this back to our experience from last week. It's basically, in these cases, it's self-deception, ego, ego doing its own thing, right, which we call these, is a philosophy of idolatry, self-serving.
True. But the question, there's a couple steps to how they get that. In other words,
but I'm saying in our cases, for example, if it wasn't Trump and his freaking ego, right, this, none of this would be this crazy, in my opinion.
Going back to a couple cycles ago, like a Mitt Romney versus Barack Obama.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Trump's ego and he's speaking out as a role model, a president, most people look at the principals as a role model and a leader, right? So this is what we have, and the same guy who was on Howard Stern talking about the Patrick Bill.
Well, I mean, like, I definitely feel that what you're talking about, like Mitt Romney versus Barack Obama, like, I feel like there wasn't that, what you're talking about, this, like, rage and bubbles and people in their own little spheres as much as we currently are.
Right.
I don't know if I have a good reason why we've been there, but, I mean, I personally know that I am much more emotionally affected by discussing these topics now than I used to be. But I think that's also because Trump is a very polarizing figure, right? And so I think that has something to do with it. I mean, for me, it's about dealing with a politician who just seems to be able to do whatever he wants. I mean, so as you're talking about Javier Mello from just being able to, like, take a wife and this and that, like, we don't seem to have a end threshold for what we find, you know, what can be explained away or found acceptable right now.
Okay. True. All right, guys, I'm running out of time, so I'll share a possibility of this idea. In other words, when the conversation, there seems to be varying degrees of intensity, is directly linked to, in other words, you can have a conversation about what is the best way to govern United States. What, let's say, economic theory, is it a conservative approach, which is a smaller government approach, or a democratic, which is where government takes a larger role? And that could be a very academic conversation, and people could present various positions, and that might even be a boring conversation for many people. That might be like a C-SPAN conversation. You know, people, But the way that it's been articulated, and this is the with the negative, it's like if you vote for Biden, you're taking America into becoming not just socialist but communist. So it becomes attributed to, you know, the most extreme radical expression of, in other words, the radical extremes of both parties have taken a much more aggressive stance, and basically it's not a calm conversation about what is the best policy of taxation, what is the best policy in immigration, what is the best policy of foreign policy. You can have relatively, you know, intellectual conversations. Now one party becomes an intense ideology of who is the good person. Are you the Republican person who is freed from imprisoning governmental control and truly providing freedom for America, or you take a Democrat, if you believe in the Republican, as fundamentally you're a racist, you have bought into systemic racism, you have bought into the patriarchal a worldview. In other words, these very extreme things that you are these very intense identities have taken over the political process. Part of it is because negative ads and negative campaigning does work. A, B is the discourse has, you know, been going down and down over years. Trump taking it to a next level. So it becomes like, you know, either you're with me or you're against me. And it becomes like this very much a clear sense of intense ideological being, and therefore the issues, which there could be merits on both sides, because not everybody has all the insight in every area, because government and governing people is a very complicated area, and how to run a democracy in 2020 objectively is a very hard thing. And quite frankly, it does not lend itself to simple and pat answers and sound bites. And reality is far, it's not so simple. Everything is very complicated. But the bottom line is that that's what's happened. I want to end with, I've got 2 minutes left, I want to end at 9:15, just to point out, one of the most amazing elements of the whole episode is that Avram After he returns Sara, he davens for Avimelech and his family to get better. Now, one thing is to reconcile with somebody, but there might be some residual aggression. Avram Avinu is engaged in prayer to the Almighty that the person who abducted his wife and put her in the harem, he is praying for his well-being because he saw that he had, as was mentioned, the tshuva, and that he had made right, and he wanted a reconciliation. And Avram is really the gold standard of when a person sees a person make a mistake, they apologize, they want to improve the relationship. Avram is picked in the halacha as the mark of what is the way when somebody has insulted you, when somebody has done wrong to you, when somebody has acted improperly to you, and comes to you in an honest, sincere way and says, I was wrong. I am sorry. I want to restore the relationship. What is the responses? Forgiveness. Not only forgiveness, to the extent that I want to help you. Avram prays for Avimelech. And that really is my, to end off our evening, I am praying for America, that each side can forgive each other for all the nastiness and ill will, because I do believe that all Americans do want what's best for America. They just have different visions of how to get there, and the trust and respect has been demolished. And hopefully we can follow in Avram's footsteps and get to a place where there can be a reconciliation and there can be a prayer for the well-being of everyone. All right, everybody, have a great night.
Thanks, Rabbi.
You got it.
Thank you.
Thank you.